This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Beverly McKeever was already a rising star in the contemporary art world when a pair of filmmakers approached her about making a documentary. But they got more than they bargained for when they turned their cameras on this talented painter. Shortly after filming began, Beverly made good on a promise to her mother. She became the main caretaker for her developmentally disabled older sister, Renee. Fulfilling that responsibility took the sisters and the filmmakers on a 6-year journey from New York to Arizona and eventually Greensboro, North Carolina, where Beverly and Renee grew up. The result is the documentary Raising Renee, which debuted on HBO this year. Beverly McKeever has an endowed professorship of art at North Carolina Central University in Durham, and she's my guest on the program this hour. Beverly, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
The film ends in Greensboro, North Carolina, which is where your life journey began. What was life like for you growing up there?
Well, it was hard to grow up in Greensboro. We grew up in a housing project, Morningside Homes, which is no longer there. And it was during a time when the KKK in 1979 came and killed 5 people in front of our apartment complex, where my mother witnessed it and was, you know, subpoenaed to testify against the KKK. So, I was bused K through 12 to across town to predominantly white schools. So it was a tough time and made it difficult for me to, I got this thing in my head about black was bad because that was the projects and white was right because I went to these predominantly white schools.
And you talk about in the film the fact that you certainly made white friends, but you didn't want them to know where you lived.
That's right. That's right. I can clearly remember once when one of my white friend's mother said, "We'll give you a ride home." And I said, okay. And I got in this Mercedes, which was like a luxury car. And she took me and I said, oh, this is my house right here. And it wasn't my house. I just got out in front of it and waved goodbye and waited for them to disappear. And I walked the rest of the way home.
Yeah, it's one thing to be conscious of class, that sort of thing, not wanting your wealthier friends to see your humble home. But this is not, you were born in 62. That's a couple of years after the lunch counter sit-ins, of course, at Woolworth's. I wonder what your sense of the racial climate was, if it was more than just you're being worried about a class distinction here, if you could feel racial tension.
Well, I could. I mean, I knew that I was different. I think most of it had to do with, I mean, not only was it with school, but it was also with my mother's occupation as a domestic worker. Because occasionally she would take us with her because we were sick at home and she couldn't leave us at home. And we would go, you know, to these luxurious homes and sit quietly on the sofa, and we couldn't move, basically, until my mother finished cleaning. So, I think I was aware of it economically and racially.
Your mother,
there was a difference.
Your mother, Ethel, has passed away, but she's documented in the film. And in the film, we have a clip of her describing her work. Let's listen.
I got a job when I was 10 years old. This lady had a baby, and she wanted me to wash the diapers for her. Now, I am 10 years old, and I remember so well. You had to stand outside of the house and hope that the sun was shining. You might not get so cold. But so many times I have put them clothes up on the line, and the minute my hand touched that line, freeze. The clothes would freeze, and so did my hand. And I just, sometimes it was just so miserable until I'd be hanging up clothes and crying.
That's from the documentary Raising Renee. Beverly McKeever, who is the subject of that documentary, is here today. That was her mother, Ethel. What was your understanding about the way she understood her relationship with white family? She sounds somewhat accepting of it all.
She was very accepting of it. She considered it her her calling, and that she was very fortunate to have a job. She only had an eighth grade education, and she felt like if she, you know, prayed for the people that she worked for, the ones that were not so nice to her, that she could change them. So it was a very, very different take on it than what I had.
At the time, were you aware, or was your sense of it much different than that? Were you angry at the time, or have a different sense when you were younger at that time?
You know, I wasn't angry at that time because, you know, a lot of those people that my mother worked for provided us with things that we would not have had otherwise. Like, you know, there was Boots Hinkle, who you see in the film, would give us Easter baskets and would give us gifts at Christmas. And those are things that my mother couldn't afford, or they would give us a ham for, you know, for Easter. So without that kind of gifting, we wouldn't have had those things.
It must be difficult. That's why I ask this question this way, because for a little kid growing up, a lot of those families were nice. They were swell people. And so the subtlety of the relationship and the power relationships might have been lost on you, certainly understood at the time,
right,
as a 7 and 8 year old girl. And then you reflect on it later, as you have in your paintings, paintings famously of yourself in blackface and also in clown makeup, whiteface.
Right, right. Well, you know, I wanted to be a clown when I was growing up. I was part of the Grimsley High School Clown Club, me and my sister Ronnie. And we were just, you know, the only blacks basically in this clown club. And so we had to dress in whiteface the entire time, cover our entire bodies. And so that's where that originated from. And I loved it. I mean, it was a way that I could erase everything, the housing project, the fact that we were poor, you know, everything. So it was a liberation for me. And I wanted to be a professional clown. I tried out for Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus Clown College. Got rejected.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Didn't get
I
in.
Forgive them. Kinda.
Well, it's interesting how Beverly McKeever then, as the artist, has recontextualized that experience, because what you reflect in those paintings isn't necessarily a desire to join the circus.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that white face was a liberation, you know, because again, keep in mind that I thought white was right, so I could be white. And then years later, I saw a dance performance at Duke University where everybody was in blackface. And then I was like, oh, my God, I can be a black clown. And so I went out the next day and got black grease paint and an Afro wig and became black.
And we should talk about your sister, Renee, too, who is the subject of the documentary and the subject of much of your work. You've done paintings on Renee. Tell us about her disability and what it was like growing up with her.
Well, Renee is currently 53 years old, and she has the mindset of a third grader. So she was diagnosed at birth as being mentally retarded, was the term that they used. And she has epilepsy. So growing up with Renee was a huge challenge for me and my sister, other sister, Ronnie, because Renee, as an adolescent, was very violent, and she was on a lot of medication. They hadn't figured out the right dosage to sort of level her off. And so she was mean. She would do things like throw me down the stairs or, you know, hit me with the telephone. And we were defenseless. I mean, we couldn't hit her back because my mother always said, she can't help it. She can't help it. So don't you strike back.
And told you that you were lucky that that didn't happen to you.
That's exactly right.
In the moment, there's that moment in the film, and we played the tape a little bit earlier as the show began, where you talk about painting her face. You're doing a portrait, essentially, and you begin to sort of scratch it out. Was that the first time you had this sense of rage? Was that the first time it expressed itself?
That was the first time that I had expressed the rage. I mean, I started painting Renee sort of on the same side, you know, as an outsider, you know, marginalized. You know, I was a black woman artist. I felt that same sort of marginalization. And So Renee was, I was like, you know, we're both in the margin. And then all of a sudden, I didn't even know what I was doing. I just started scratching her face out. So it was very scary to me to do that because I didn't know where it was coming from.
On the State of Things this hour, my guest is artist Beverly McKeever. She's an endowed professor of art at North Carolina's Central University. She's the subject of a new HBO documentary film called Raising Renee, and you can find out more about Beverly McKeever at beverlymckeever.com. McKeever is spelled, by the way, M-C-I-V-E-R. Our conversation will continue. Beverly's going to talk about becoming the main caretaker for her sister, Renee. That on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest is artist Beverly McKeever. A retrospective of her work is on display now at the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh. Many of the paintings there are inspired by Beverly's childhood in Greensboro, North Carolina, where she lived in the projects with her mentally disabled sister, Renee. It wasn't easy, and Beverly couldn't wait to leave that all behind. She did, but she came back and took care of Renee after their mother died. Beverly's relationship with Renee is the subject of a new documentary on HBO called Raising Renee.
Mama told Beverly that I want you to do me a favor. She said, I want you to start to raising Renee. And Beverly accept. She said, okay. So she's doing a good job. And I like it a lot.
So Renee likes it a lot. You didn't always like it a lot. And tell us about this promise you made to your mother. Tell us about that.
Well, my mom asked me if I would take care of Renee if she died. And my mother was completely healthy when she asked. And, you know, I thought parents live forever. Mm-hmm. So I thought, yeah, sure, why not? You know, I can do it. You know, I was thinking that, you know, by the time my mother died, I would be so wealthy that I could just hire someone to do the deed for me. And, you know, then like a couple of, she asked me a couple of years before she died. And then she got sick and died of pancreatic cancer.
It was pretty
rather
quick.
Suddenly.
Yeah.
It's very sudden.
Yeah.
And I was living in New York at the time. And I left New York to come back and to take care of Renee because I felt like I couldn't take care of her in New York.
Did you, when your mother got sick, did it occur to you that you had made this promise you're now going to have to make good? I mean, what I'm getting at is, was there any point where you said, oh, no, I can't do this?
No.
So you always
You can't do that. you know, I was like, oh, my God, what have I promised? I mean, the whole idea was really sort of scary to me, but I had to do it. Just had to do it. So
you came back, and what did you do next?
Well, I moved from New York back to Arizona, and Renee moved out to Arizona with me. And it was just too difficult for us to live there and for me to take care of her. I was in Arizona because I had a job at Arizona State, and I was tenured. But there was no support system, no family, you know, nothing. So it's just too difficult. And Renee missed being in North Carolina. So
there's a lovely moment in the film where it does seem that Renee was making the adjustment better than you, in that she said she wanted to start going out with some guys. She wanted to start meeting some guys. But she figured, well, I'm here in Arizona. I'm going to get me a white boyfriend.
That's right.
Good thought, because there aren't any black men in
Arizona. That's exactly right. So. Yeah, she's smarter than I am on some issues, and the boyfriend was definitely, because I was like, well, you know, there are black people out here. I just haven't seen them yet. That's what I was thinking, and she was like, no, I'm gonna get me a white boy immediately.
She made the adjustment, but you realized this was not a good place for you. I actually want to take you back a few steps to when you got involved in painting, because you went to North Carolina Central as an undergrad, but a psychology major.
That's correct.
So you weren't planning on doing any kind of art when you started school?
Was not planning on being an artist because I had heard that artists are poor. And I'd already done that gig and was not interested in being poor. So I was going to major in something that would make me some money, psychology. And I took a painting class with my fabulous teacher, Elizabeth, at Central as an elective. And, you know, I fell in love with it. And she was like, you know, you could really be great at this if you just work hard at it. And I took those words to heart and just believed that she was right. For some reason.
Well, let's talk about that reason, because it does seem kind of crazy on the face of it. Yeah, you're going to end up poor. Somebody's reinforced. It clearly kind of feels good to be told you've got a talent.
Yes.
But was there anything that you saw in the work itself as a kind of expression or something about that work that made you think, you know, I just need to do this?
Well, I don't think I saw anything in the work except I just enjoyed it. I enjoyed doing it, and intuitively it felt right. And, you know, I mean, I trust my intuition much, much more now than I did then. But, you know, just her saying it was like, you know, it was like God was saying, you know, this is your path, you know, take it.
What kind of work did you imagine yourself doing?
Well, at the time I was making still lives. And people were interested in, there was a gallery dealer that was like, you know, I can sell these. And so I had some positive reinforcement about the still lives, you know, that people, you know, that white people were willing to buy them and hang them in their house. In fact, one of the women that my mother worked for said, can she paint some apples for me? You know, and so I did. And she gave me like $50 for it, which I thought, okay, I can make some money.
Then your work this took a decided turn for social consciousness and
yes.
awareness. You began to do, we talked about earlier, your work in blackface. What inspired those works?
The blackface works?
Yeah.
Well, it was totally inspired by my mother's occupation as a maid. You know, I mean, I felt like some of the people that she worked for saw her as a mammy figure. Saw her literally in that blackface, in part because of the way that they treated her. You know, some people would not prepare lunch for her. I mean, she was working 8 hours cleaning their houses, and she would come home, and the first thing she would do was run to the kitchen to get something to eat because she hadn't eaten all day. So the exploration for the blackface really originated with my mother's occupation and, you know, just sort of investigating some of those ideas.
Interestingly enough, though, you've come in for a lot of criticism on those paintings from African-American women, largely,
right.
Who said, hey, that's not me. What are you doing, Beverly?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's a painful thing to look at. I mean, it hurts me to think about it and to make those paintings and everything that I feel when I'm making those paintings, I try to push on to the viewer. And so I think it just made them feel uncomfortable. It definitely made me feel uncomfortable, you know, with my body shape. And I felt like, you know, that I too was an Aunt Jemima in many ways. I mean, my world has been, you know, except for living in the projects, my world has been basically white. And so, you know, from going to Penn State, which is predominantly white, to getting a job in Arizona, you know, I felt that same sort of feeling, like I had characterized my mother as Aunt Jemima. I felt that.
Do you feel differently when the painting's finished, when you're talking about being uncomfortable working on it? What changes for you, if anything, when you're finished?
Well, the feelings are still there. I mean, I think the thing that is a saving grace is that it becomes sort of a healing process. I mean, I've put something out there that will make the viewer question how they feel about those images and perhaps even make peace with it. You know, maybe a black woman looking at it will say, oh, yeah, you know, make peace with it and move on. Or, you know, maybe a white person will look at it and say, oh, my God, am I looking at my, you know, Latino maid today and thinking something similar? Or so in men, you know, oh, I've never seen her as an attractive sexy creature, and perhaps just sort of questioning all those responses and coming up with new ones.
And talk a little bit about your process, these lush paintings and the texture that you leave on the canvas. Was that something, how did you develop that? When did that come into your work?
Well, I'm a big fan of Bay Area figurative artists like Richard Diebenkorn and David Parks, whose paintings are very, very luscious. And I've looked at them for, since I was in school. I was very interested in making surfaces that were luscious and like ice cream, like icing on a cake, because I knew the subject matter was going to be tough. So I had to have a way to draw people in. I work from a primary palette. So what that means is I work with two reds, two blues, and two yellows and white, and I mix all of my colors. So I wanted the colors to be, straight from me, how I see color, luscious, so that people will be drawn to the artwork and then get the social commentary.
Well, it's one of the effects, at least it is for me, in that you can't see this without wanting to touch it, and that level of engagement doesn't allow you to see it as a piece of work on the wall. The glass between you is broken forever, and you feel like, uh-oh, not only do I want to touch it, I need to respond to it.
That's right.
When have I done that? And then you have to plead guilty to a few of those things. Yeah. So it does have that impact. How do you take the criticism, though? I mean, here are people who are saying to you, you're just making things worse for us.
Well, I try to not take it that serious. Simply because I believe that this is my voice and that I'm speaking for people and that it's very, very important for me to keep on this journey. So I trust my intuition and I trust what I'm doing well enough to know that even if I'm hurting some people in the process, I'm saving more.
Hmm. Renee's a bit of an artist herself. She makes potholders.
Yes, she does.
And lots of them.
Lots of them. There's a back order for potholders. Please do not call my website and ask me for potholders.
Well, you say in the film, that's the nightmare, isn't it?
Yes, it still is.
Which is that?
That Renee's potholder will end up on the cover of Art in America instead of one of my paintings.
She was there at an opening for you in New York and met the editor of an art magazine.
Yes. She met the editor of Art in America, Raphael Rubinstein. And he wanted a potholder. And Renee, because she has such a great business sense, said, "You owe me $1.25.
He really thought
and
it was
he had
gift.
No money.
He reached in, said, "Which one would you like?" He picked it up. And of course, yeah, what do you take? Visa, MasterCard, American
right.
Express, because I don't have a buck and a quarter.
Exactly.
It was a great moment in the film. Tell us a little bit about, and I understand they've gone up.
Yes, they're now $8.
Wow.
That's right, inflation.
Wow.
Remember, that was that part of the film was filmed 6 years ago.
Right.
So,
potholders and gasoline, I guess.
That's right.
Tell us about the film now, because you were approached by filmmaker Stephen Asher and Gene Jordan. When did that happen?
Yes.
What was going on?
Well, it happened in 2003. Gene Jordan and I were Radcliffe Fellows at the Radcliffe Institute of Advanced Studies at Harvard, and her studio space was across from mine. And she would come into my studio and say, "Your paintings look like film stills." And at that time, I was working on the laundry pieces. And she was like, I think me and my husband should do a film about you. And I was thinking, that's ridiculous. What could you possibly, want a film about my life?
And you didn't, at this point, you hadn't really developed the reputation that you have since.
No.
Not at
no,
all.
No, right? I did. I had received the Guggenheim. And an award from Creative Capital, but no, I was just working. My mother was healthy, so Renee was living in North Carolina with my mother, and I was just you know, doing these fabulous fellowships.
So this was going to be a film about a budding artist on the threshold. And of course, Renee was in no way a part of the original concept because, as you say, she was doing fine with your mom.
Right. That's correct. It was going to be about me and my art and that they look like film stills and how they move and the painting process, etc.
There are actually some nice moments in the film where they do a dissolve from a scene. I remember one in particular where there's a group of people praying around your mother's bed when she's in the hospital, and it dissolves to a still that you did, a painting.
Yes.
And what's interesting is that it's not exactly a representational painting. The faces are different, and it's clear it's not representational. And yet, yeah, they're right. Wow, they almost fit, you know, sort of figure for figure.
Right, right. Well, the filmmakers are really fabulous at you know, making the paintings work in the storyline. I mean, they did a fabulous job of that. And, you know, she proved to me that, you know, maybe the paintings do look like film stills.
What about the change, though, that the direction of this thing took? All of a sudden, you're going to be responsible for Renee. Why did you decide? Because I guess it was up to you to let the cameras keep rolling in this new phase.
Right. Well, you know, first of all, let me say that I never thought the film would be on HBO. You know, when somebody says they want to make a film about you, you think, oh, yeah, whatever. You're an artist. I understand you need people. You know, sometimes I go out and get people to paint. I get it. So you think, okay. And you're just very casual about it. And I didn't think much of it. I mean, Steve Asher, who is the person that does the filming, was very, very good at making himself completely invisible. Most of the time, I was not aware that he was there. You know, I mean, he would be right in my face, but he would not, you know, laugh at my jokes or show any kind of judgment on his face the whole time he was filming. He just had a smirk that was just sort of blank. So I didn't know I was funny until I saw the film. I had no idea.
Oh, it is great. And there are these moments where you're really, you know, sort of talking out loud. And I had to wonder, I said, well, there's a film crew in there. Is she really? Because it seems so authentic. It is clear that those are your thoughts. So that's what it was.
That's why.
His ability to kind of fade behind.
He was so invisible. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was one time when he said to me, this is the only time that I was aware of his presence. And he said, you know, we're going to start filming now. So I had on my nightgown and he said, do you want to put on a bra? And I thought, heck no, I don't want to put on a bra. I'm in my house. I'm going to be comfortable. You know, and he said, okay. And that's one of my big regrets throughout the film. I wish I'd put on a bra. What was I thinking?
So now let's talk about this decision to come back. You're in Arizona. You do decide to come back with Renee to North Carolina. What led to that decision?
Yeah. Well, it was a couple of things. I mean, Renee in Arizona and me taking care of her was just too much. I mean, I was still traveling and giving lectures. And so Renee was traveling with me. We would leave together and speak. And, you know, it just wasn't a good life for me. It was too taxing. And it wasn't a good life for Renee. So I got an offer from North Carolina Central University to come back. They had just given me an honorary doctorate degree the year before. And at the ceremony, the chancellor asked if I would consider coming back. And I thought, oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, what do you say? You're on stage. Sure.
But you have, and you had thoughts about North Carolina, certainly Greensboro. And, you know, you expressed these in the film about always feeling your color when you come back here. This is the place. Right. And so, it's a place to come back, but you had to confront that. Were your emotions mixed about coming back?
They were very mixed. In part because I, you know, every time I come back to Greensboro, you know, I'm reminded that I'm black. You know, whether it's through service at a restaurant or someone following me in a store because they think I'm going to steal something. I just hate that. I absolutely hate that. And, you know, I thought it doesn't matter how many degrees you have or, you know, how much money you have or where you live. You know, you're still, Greensboro reminded me that I was still a black girl from the projects.
On the state of things today, we'll talk about how that girl did well and did well by herself, her career as an artist, and her sister when she raised Renee. Beverly McKeever, our conversation continues on the state of things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Beverly McKeever, an artist with an endowed professorship at North Carolina Central University and featured in the new HBO documentary film Raising Renee. You can see that now on HBO, and you can hear Beverly McKeever this moment on The State of Things. So another thing that we learn about you in this film is that you and Renee had different fathers, something that you didn't know, but apparently the rest of Greensboro did, until you were a teenager.
That's correct. Yes, my mother had an affair with my father, who is a taxi cab driver in Greensboro, and I was the product of that affair.
And tell us about discovering your father and your relationship with him.
Well, I was 17 years old, and my mother and I were actually standing in the kitchen. We were still in the projects, and she says, you know, guess what? And I said, what? And she said, your father's at the door. And I said, what? And she said, yeah. And I turn around and there's this big guy standing at the door who's like, hey, how are you? So.
And by this time, you Renee and Ronnie's father had left. So he wasn't in the family.
That's correct.
Anymore. And you meet your biological father. So what did you do?
Oh, my God, I was devastated. I mean, I was shocked and a bit angry at the way that my mother, because, you know, I had no time to say, well, what? How did that happen? He was just there. And I didn't know what to say to him. It was a very strange thing. But I think that he was very eager for my mother to tell me about him because he wanted a relationship with me.
And you developed that relationship.
Yes. Yep. I go see him and I talk to him once a week. Today's his birthday. He's 86 years old. So yesterday I spent the day with him, Renee and my other sister, Ronnie, and her husband. And we all went out to dinner to celebrate his birthday.
Now, I happen to know where you went and I know why you went there. So I'd like to ask you about that, where you went to dinner yesterday.
Yeah, well, my father, you know, I take him out to dinner every year for his birthday. And we went to Golden Corral once. And, you know, I think that was the year before, a couple of years ago. And I think he felt uncomfortable there. And then last year we went to this place called Stephanie's, which is a black-owned restaurant. And he really liked that. And that's where he wanted to go yesterday. So we went there initially. And it was so packed. I mean, it's like every black church in Greensboro had descended upon them. So my sister recommended this place called Sunday Best. And we went there. It's only open on Sunday. It's run by black people. And my father loved it. He loved it. He was like, everybody's so nice here. And, you know, and they just treated him well and wished him a happy birthday. And it was just and it was soul food.
Well, it's interesting that he would find not unusual that he would find it uncomfortable to be in those other places. But here you are, his daughter, who has navigated this mostly white world all of her professional life and then having to come back to Greensboro and kind of cope with these things.
Right.
And develop
a
relationship again.
Yeah. Well, in Greensboro, my world is, you know, when I go with my family, it's definitely black. I mean, we go to black restaurants and, you know, I mean, we eat food that hurts my stomach.
What was it like for you knowing that now suddenly finding out that the father you thought was your father, that your sister's father wasn't yours? Did that change things for you about how you felt about yourself?
Well, you know, my Renee and Ronnie's father was never around. I mean, he left when we were three. So he left, you know, really young. And I didn't have, it wasn't like I had some loving relationship with him. So, you know, at least this was an opportunity to have a relationship with, you know, a father figure.
What does your father think of his daughter, the artist?
Well, you know, he's funny. I don't even know if he really can grasp the whole concept. I mean, I made a portrait of him, and I've made several portraits of him, one of which I gave to him, and he keeps it in the closet because he says it's safe there. And then I told him that I had sold one of my paintings of him in the hospital for $10,000, and he said, "Wow, Viv," he calls me Viv. He said, "Wow, Viv, that's the price of a car." So I don't know if he really, you know, can grasp the whole concept of artists making art and painting and selling them for, you know, what he would consider a year's salary.
What did taking care of Renee do to your art? It's a lot of work, and that's clear in the film that you know, you can't just do what you want to do when you want to do it when you're taking care of Renee.
Right.
What effect did it have on your art?
Well, it slows me down quite a bit, you know, in part because I couldn't hop up and go to an artist colony and, you know, for a month and make artwork, you know, and have that decompression time. You know, when you're taking care of somebody, you're always on. You know, you sleep with one eye open because, you know, Renee would have seizures at night. So I would, you know, have to hear for that, listen out for that. And so you're always on guard. And it just changed everything. I mean, it changed things that made me work in a different way. I had to set up where I would say to Renee, "Look, we're both artists. We're both going to go in our studios. You're going to make your potholders, and I'm going to make my paintings, and we'll come out in 2 hours, you know, and take a break."
Well, does it affect the way you think about your subjects? The fact that you have to take more time to do things, is that for the better, for the worse? Does it make a change in how your work turns out?
Well, I think it does. Does have a toll on that, because what happens is my work is very emotional, and so I have to feel those emotions in order to push that on to the viewer, into the painting. And so therefore, you know, that downtime where I go down, sometimes I would sob in front of my paintings, but I didn't want Renee to see me sobbing because then she would get upset. So it really did change the way that, you know, I worked. And when I worked, you know, when Renee would go to sleep at night, where she couldn't catch me, you know, crying.
Well, the authenticity, the integrity of the artist, and certainly in your work, comes through when you teach as well. There's a nice moment in the film that catches you as a teacher. And, we'll let this clip speak for itself. Let's listen.
"You probably don't care about that tie, and you made it beautiful, juicy, and luscious. But then your face, you're like,
it's my face. Oh, my God, I got to make myself look good."
"You're becoming a little self-conscious. Okay, don't do that in front of me, because you're just going to mess it up. Don't do that. But I think if you put this in, then it'll help you give you these answers."
"Okay.
But it's working, Chris. It looks good.
Okay.
I'm proud of you."
"Put that brush down. Don't do that now."
"What are you doing, you idiot?"
Well, there's a little bit of that. But the other thing, the notion about the face, that you're trying to make yourself look too good, you caught that. You catch yourself doing that, saying you're not being honest, Renee, or Beverly?
No. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, it's almost like I go into a trance when I'm in the studio and when I'm working, and I just really try to move my conscious self aside and let it rip, because I know I'm going to get my best work there, even if it makes me sad or, you know, feel vulnerable. I know it's going to be my best work, so I don't have that problem in the studio.
Why do you think your mother extracted that promise from you to raise Renee and not your sister?
That's a good question. We need a medium to ask her that.
or someone who grew up in her house.
I think she asked Renee, "Who do you want to live with?" And Renee said, you know, Renee, who's, you know, supposed to be disabled, right?
Mm-hmm.
She said, "I can continue the life I live if I stay with my sister Ronnie. You know, we can do the same routine, blah, blah. Or I can go live with my sister Beverly, who lives across the United States and who flies all over the place and travels a lot. And she'll let me do whatever I want. And she'll buy me lots of loops for my potholders. I mean, it's a no-brainer.
Wow. And it worked out. She always seemed to be happy wherever you went.
Yeah. Yeah. She was.
And now she's living on her own.
She's living on her own. Yep. 2 years, going on 2 years now.
And that seemed to be a bit of a surprise for both of you, the idea that she could really live independently.
Yeah. I felt like she could. And, you know, I felt like she, you know, I thought about myself and I thought about how, you know, how anxious I was to get out of the house and have my own apartment and eat whatever I wanted and make my own rules. And I thought, you know, that's just human nature that everybody wants to do that. And I thought that that would be a great idea for Renee to at least experience it. So I said, you can do it. If you don't like it, you can come back and live with me. So last year when her lease ran out, I went to Renee and I said, okay, you've been here a year. You can either stay here another year or you can come back and live with me. And she said, I know you want me to come back and live with you, but I think I'm going to stay where I am. And I just smiled at her because I was like, thank you, God. Thank you, God.
So you didn't really. I mean, are you feel? How do you feel that she, now that she's out of the house?
It's fabulous.
Yeah.
Are you kidding? I mean, it's fabulous. I mean, I love living by myself. I love all 3,400 square foot of my house. It, you know, could be a little bit larger. But I love it. I just need that space. So if she had said, I want you to come back and live with me, oh my God, I would have been depressed about that.
Mm. Was it hard for you? I mean, were there moments when she was living with you that you thought to yourself, well, this can't go on. It's got to stop.
Oh God. Yeah.
Yeah. But you didn't make it stop. Why not?
Well, I didn't. I mean, what can I do? I'm not going to put her in a home.
You could have put her in a home.
No.
You could have said, look, it's better for you. I'm busy. You have all this care. The people, they're very nice. They're professionals. I'm not. I mean, that's what we say, isn't it?
Yeah, but I would have felt so guilt-ridden that, you know, I wouldn't be able to live with myself. So that just really wasn't an option. I mean, you know, Renee's 53. She's not going to be able to live in that apartment by herself forever. So she's eventually going to have to go somewhere. We just hope by then I'll be rich again.
Be rich again, perhaps, on your next project. What are you working on?
Well, I'm working on a series of paintings about myself. I mean, now that Renee is taken care of and happy, I can focus on myself. And I can focus on things that I've been wanting to do but haven't had the opportunity to do. So,
including body image.
Including body image, yeah. So in December, on my 49th birthday, December 14th, I turned 49, I had a breast reduction. So the fabulous plastic surgeon removed 6 pounds from my chest. Mm. Yeah. So, which was life-altering because I've had breasts since I was, you know, born. And I've always been associated, you know, in high school I was picked on because I had big boobs. You know, men have always stared at my chest instead of talking to my face. And so now they're not there anymore.
Well, for an artist like you, this whole change in body image has got to be remarkable material.
It's big. It's big.
Not
I mean,
anymore.
I have these.
Oh, forgive me. I'm sorry.
A handful. That's all they are. I'm just a handful now, but that's big enough. I mean, it's so fantastic. I mean, you know, my breasts aren't hanging down. They're perky. They're 20-year-old breasts.
Does this mean you'll lose your endowed chair? I'm sorry. Where are we going with this, Beverly? You led me down this path.
Blame me, Frank. Yeah. Are you staring at my breasts, Frank?
I was looking you right in the eye. And this is amazing. So now this, because body image, your exploration of color has been so remarkable, and now the notion of the female body image through your own experience.
Right, right. So I'm painting my breasts. I'm showing them off because I'm so proud of them. And they're beautiful, and I'm proud of, you know, all the bras. You know, when you're a large girl, your bras only come in beige, white, and black. And now I can, you know, I have fuchsia and blue and lace and gems hanging from and red. It's really exciting.
You shared a moment with me earlier that I think we should share with the audience about an interview you did in New York with a reporter.
Yes.
And so tell us.
Well, I had the New York Times came down. A reporter came down and spent the entire day with me. And she's a lovely girl. I mean, she was really very petite, you know, size 4 or 6, something like that. And, you know, I told her that I was recovering from, you know, this breast surgery. And I told her that I had these new bras and everything. And she was like, oh, my God. And I said, she was like, this is so fabulous. This is great. And I said, do you want to see my breasts? And she said, yes. I mean, no. I mean, yes. So.
You're bringing the chaperones in order for that to happen. But is there any part of you that resents having to do that?
No. I mean, you know, I come from a family of large breasts. Mm-hmm. And so we've all had big breasts. And my sister had a breast reduction, you know, several years ago, my sister Ronnie. And just like, you know, this is the best thing that I ever did. So I was scared because I thought, you know, I've been so identified with breasts all of my life. And I thought, oh, my God, who will I be without breasts? Will that just erase me completely? And
how do you feel? Who are you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm my next series of paintings.
We will
Frank.
See in the next series of paintings. Beverly McKeever, what a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much.
It's very nice talking to you, too.
Beverly McKeever is an endowed professor of art at her alma mater, North Carolina Central University. A retrospective of her work on display in North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh through June 24th. Get out and see that. Craven Art Gallery as well in Durham is exhibiting some of Beverly's paintings through April 7th. Raising Renee, you can see on HBO. And all of that is available, again, at our website, stateofthings.org, if you want more information about her work and the various places you can see it and the documentary. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.